Thanks for joining me. My name is Ibrahim Sani. I have on the line with me a good friend of mine, the founder and the managing partner of RHL Ventures, Raja Hamzah. Raja Hamzah is, of course, spearheading RHL Ventures, one of the hottest VCs in town. Hamzah, let's run through with some of the ideas on RHL Ventures right now, particularly in terms of the assets under management. Maybe you can share with us the AUM of RHL Ventures and look at some of the sectors that are being the biggest beneficiary of the fund so far.
Sure. Thank you, Ibrahim, for taking the time. Hamza here, the founder of RHL Ventures. I think our AUM now is close to ₱1 billion, managing across venture equity and venture debt opportunities. Among the sectors that we spent a lot of our effort and time in over the past 12 months include fintech and financial inclusion. We have a company called Versa that we invested in that's doing very well, which offers savings and investments for M40 and D40 participants. That's one. Number two, it's a thematic. Renewables is a big way, energy transition, EVs. We are looking at closing a couple of deals in that space at the moment. Number three, in terms of, as you mentioned earlier, food security. Agri and food is a space that we've spent a lot of time, effort in the past 24 months. We have about 5 to 6 deals in that space, ranging from alternative protein, upstream, downstream, supply chain, and that's, I think, a big focus as we help Malaysia improve its self-sufficiency ratio for some of the key crops. And lastly, I think on the commerce side, whether it's modest commerce, halal fashion, I think this area that we love to see Malaysia grow as a space, and we feel that it's, I think, regionally relevant as well. So I think within these sectors that we're looking at, we've already been investing and are going to invest more. I think this year so far, we've done close to about 8 deals. And I think we are probably going to go into a double-digit number by end of the year. And as we approach 2024, we want to be aggressive in terms of timing the markets. We believe that in this tech winter, I think Malaysia has been largely insulated from it. There are still strong opportunities across the early stage space. And given that there's lack of funders in Malaysia, I think a guy like us that's well-funded, that's supported by both local and international investors, I think we have a great place to play in the space.
The thing is, Hamza, RHL Ventures has been reported as holding talks with various parties, particularly sovereign wealth funds and foreign funds, to launch other funds. Is that on the cards right now? And maybe you can give us a little bit of update on this?
I think all these are, discussions, obviously a lot of them are PNC. I think we've in touch with quite a few of the local sovereigns and quite a few of them have showed concrete interest, and we're discussing term sheets with them. That's one. But I think more importantly, I think we've had support from also the Korean sovereign before. And also now I think we've having quite a bit of talks with the guys in the Middle East, right? So we've hosted quite a few guys in Malaysia. I think they are excited about Malaysia's potential as a hub for tech and also a hub for manufacturing semiconductors across the region. So I think we are kind of trying to just piggyback on that and invest together with them. So I think as a whole, I think on the sovereign wealth fund space, given that I think your traditional funders have slowed down, the sovereigns have kept on chugging ahead, and whether it's locally, whether it's regionally, or whether it's kind of globally, there's strong interest in our space.
Any new sectors that RHL Ventures is looking at on top of the ones that you mentioned earlier that is looking for new funding?
So I think I mentioned earlier, I think in terms of energy transition, I think that's a huge space that we are spending time on. We are close to finalizing a deal in the carbon credit space. And we believe that this space is not only relevant within the Klang Valley, but I think there's a lot of externalities, whether it's in Sarawak, whether it's in Pahang, Perak, and so on, right? So I think in the carbon credit space, Malaysia is probably well-placed given our large land bank and also our forest reserves. So I think we will have a big place to play. Secondly, I think in terms of the EV space, I think the government, MITI, has been pushing hard on that. We are fully supportive from a supply chain perspective. So I think we're looking at a couple of the supply chain guys in Penang. We're speaking to them who are traditionally guys who don't usually come to market in terms of raising venture capital funding. But I think nowadays, given that I think our brand is more well-known and the funding system is a bit more established, I think they're more interested in taking capital in that space. So I think that's two. I think number three, we still spend a lot of time in the agriculture and food space. We feel that as much as we've done quite a few deals in that space in the last 24 months, there's still a lot of low-hanging fruit in that space. It's still heavily underinvested. If you look in terms of the percentage of funding going into the space, I think if you look at as a percentage of total regional funding, I think about maybe 5 to 6% of funding is going to the food space. And you drill down Asia, there's probably about 10-20 deals are getting funded in the agri. And so in terms of numbers itself, I think the team's done the work. We're still heavily underfunded in that space. And it's where we have to play a part in. Just a kind of quick example, right? In terms of our chilies, like we import 70% of our chilies, right? So all the chilies that go into our nasi lemak, I think most of it's imported, right? So that's a big factor. Milk, 65% is imported. So I think all these things are key commodities that we need to fix, and we need to create more self-sufficiency locally, especially at a time where kind of supply chain issues still persist over time.
Seeing that you mentioned that, I want to talk to you about the NETR, or the National Energy Transition Roadmap. We've seen this was launched a few weeks ago. Again, this is in tandem with the National Industrial Master Plan that's going to be launched at the end of this month, in tandem with the Madani Economy and many more. Maybe you can share with us the house view of RHL Ventures when it comes to these kind of roadmaps.
I think, so I was at the NETR, or what Nick Nasby said, NETR at the event. I believe that, I think from a forward-looking perspective, this is good because it just shows that as a policy, from a policy-making front, the government is taking initiatives, either from a retail point of view. I think they were talking about subsidizing solar panels or solar installations for retail users, to kind of like larger scale hydrogen type project. Right? So I think from smaller scale to larger scale, there is a roadmap. And at least there's a vision that we space. Right? I always find that here locally, like we always find it difficult to articulate a vision that can be presented to foreign investors or foreign players, right? Our neighbors like Indonesia, Singapore do it very well. So now that we have a framework, at least there's something, a core policy document to work towards and to move towards. I think on the National Industrial Master Plan, that's, I think, going to be really soon. I think what's interesting is that, I think if we can help some of the financing options for a lot of these startups, right? What I find from an agri-food space or even startup space, I think what we've been discussing with policymakers is financing and how do we plug that gap. Most of the financing goes to your traditional brick and mortar guys, or even guys who are already making profit, right? So how about guys who are earlier stage? How do you underwrite that risk? How do you price that risk? I think those are important things that we are talking about with the policyholders. And I think they've been receptive in terms of how we want to approach these issues.
The objectives and goals is, of course, aiming to finance high impact startups for Malaysia and the ASEAN region. Maybe you can talk to us to that effect.
Okay, so I think this is very an interesting point from a funding point of view, right? So if you look into some of the key funders within the VC space, the guys like IFC, DEG, so IFC is obviously owned by World Bank, DEG is owned by the Germans, and these are all guys who have been funding the venture capital ecosystem within Southeast Asia, and especially in Indonesia, and in some cases in Singapore, right? Somehow Malaysia has been left out of the map for this type of funding from an impact point of view, just because I think there's been very low awareness of impact type mandates locally, and also bridging that gap to send that message across to foreign investors. I think that's changing, where we have stakeholders like, I mean, Kazana, who's spending time on a Dana impact point of view. There's also those guys like EPF are looking into impact initiatives as well, with Joanne and the whole strategic investments team. So there are steps at the right place where we can link the dots and also crowd in some of these foreign investors into the impact space. Why I talk about foreign investors, I'm just saying that these are large pools of capital targeting this space. If you look into kind of GDP capital, yes, it's on the high side from an impact point of view, but if you break it down, I mean, most of it is centered on KL, Penang, Sarawak to a certain extent, due to like states like Kelantan, Kedah, and GDP capital is kind of below 5,000 USD. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruits from an impact point of view that you can target. But as a whole, we got to package it in a way that it's palatable and understandable for foreign investors, where especially from an impact investment point of view, they meet the goals that they're looking at, right? And I think these goals are very much publicly established. IFC, for example, publishes their fundings and who they funded, why they funded, what impact initiative they're targeting. And these are all things that we as local investors can take advantage of and get crowded more foreign investment.
Okay. I understand that you're talking from the point of view of institutional investors. You're talking from the capital owners' perspective. Maybe you can share with us from the point of view of the founders themselves. Can you share with us the insights that we can look at for companies with comprehensive business plans and projections, particularly that has clear strategies for long-term growth prospects that might entice folks like you to bet on them and fund their growth?
So I think you bucketed it into kind of two buckets, right? So I think if you're looking into kind of a seed stage investment, I think the parameters are a lot different from, let's say, a Series B type investment, right? In a seed stage investment, I think the product market fit, the founder just plays a larger importance compared to a later stage opportunity, right? So in this case, you're backing the founder from and his capability to execute, and your trust in the founder to build this because you are going very early. I think on the flip side, I think when you go into a later stage, maybe a later Series A or Series B type opportunity, I think the numbers play a much bigger part of the pie, whether it's profitable, what's the growth projections like, what's the growth that's already historical growth like, what kind of multiples you're paying. I think those things play a bigger factor. The good part about the market right now as we speak, the market has grown to appreciate profitability a lot more compared to 24 months ago, right? So if you're a Series B startup and you're not making money, chances of you raising funding is very low, or you will either raise a down round or you only get money from your existing investors. So good part about this is, as we see kind of the more traditional industry and the tech industry, it used to be like, oh, one's making profits, one was kind of burning money. I think that ecosystem is changing. Shopee started making a profit. Uber made this first profit. So I think the whole ecosystem is changing in a way where we are seeing more profitable companies, but at the same time, I think profits is only expected maybe it's at the Series B onwards opportunity. Earlier stage is still very much founder focused. We speak to Malaysian founders. I think there's been a steady supply of companies coming up. The biggest issue we've seen with kind of Malaysian founders at the early stage is getting kind of your seed stage funding. And I always told the kind of stakeholder that we need more seed stage funders for it to be a vibrant ecosystem.
Could you share with us some of the insights that you have on the Malaysian economy right now, and what would be interesting for potential investors to look at?
Okay, so, I mean, obviously, the past few years, we spoke about startups, the issues with startups, and we were talking about, like, kind of where are the gaps versus our regional peers, right? So, I just came back from a trip to Vietnam, and if I had to say like for like our startups or our founders versus a Vietnamese founder, I think we are way ahead, right? But I think the issue is, what is the TAM or the that we are targeting in Malaysia versus Vietnam, and what are we buying from a hope or longer term perspective? Vietnam people buy the 100 million population and that whole story, but GDP per capita is low. So I think what's key from a forward looking perspective, at least from a Malaysian perspective, is how do we market ourselves, right? I always find one area that we can be market ourselves well, even though we may not be a huge population. Our consumer markets have been relatively strong. Consumption is a big driver of the economy. And our consumption-related businesses have proven to list very well, whether it's your Mr. DIYs, your CTOS, your Farm Freshers of the world. There is an exit opportunity in Malaysia for consumer-type businesses. So I think that's one in terms of crafting that exit narrative. That's because the exit narrative in Southeast Asia has been very dry. Guys who have come out to public markets have found it difficult to justify valuations or sustain valuations. And that's across the whole of Southeast Asia. Startups in Malaysia, or companies in Malaysia that have listed have done generally okay, whether it's the support of instant investors, whether it's support of kind of foreign investors. There's always been a stable listing environment in Malaysia. I think that's one, we need to craft the exit narrative. I think number two, people get confused when they come to Malaysia, like, what are they backing? Are we backing consumer businesses? Are we backing fintech? Are we backing automotive, right? So I think we really got to focus on a few sectors that we feel are relevant. I think the key parts that we are spending time now is, I think one is agri and food, because we feel like that's a very big ecosystem here locally. Mobility is big. That's why we talk about EVs and energy transition. And I think in terms of the commerce industry, in terms of the halal and modest commerce, I think we still have a lot of legs to run. I also believe that I think consolidation is needed for some of the smaller players to create a larger, more relevant player in the ecosystem that is able to list.
Some of these deals might not necessarily come from Malaysia as you search for growth and you search for founders and entrepreneurs. They might come from ASEAN region. And as a venture capital, you're here to maximize the kind of returns for your fund investors or your LPs. Maybe you can talk to us in terms of finding that balance of looking for the best deals to grow your fund size to get the best returns for your LPs, but at the same time, how are you going to see your growth impact in terms of growing local founders themselves?
Sure. One is, I think about half our deals are locally in Malaysia. I think we've backed quite a few local players this year itself and also last year. But at the same time, we do have a regional bucket. But the regional bucket always, what we sell ourselves in as an investor is, hey, when we invest in you, we come bring you to Malaysia, we'll help you expand. We help you build a team here locally and do business development, do manufacturing, and so on and so forth, right? So I think we look at it from two buckets. From a local funding bucket, I think we are always on the lookout for good deals. And we are spending time in Penang and Johor in the next couple of weeks to kind of expand the net and look at more startups and also SMEs over there. I think that's one factor. I think number two, in terms of our local reach in KL, I think we are Klang Valley. I think we are kind of well there with the brand and what we've built over the past 5-6 years. So I think deal flow is not an issue. And I think the key part locally is just kind of finding more startups to back and good founders to back, right? So the pipeline is there and bringing them and coaching them to raise subsequent rounds of funding. So that's our kind of target locally here in Malaysia. Regionally, always when we look at deals, we help bring them back here. Also, it creates a more vibrant ecosystem where you have kind of local and regional players, both kind of sort of like being friends, competing and within the same ecosystem. And I think when there's more talent coming in, there's ability to pay for talent. There's also a higher circulation of talent that we see versus before. We've also seen some founders from Singapore, from Indonesia, who have relocated back to Malaysia over the past 12 months, just because from a cost perspective, Malaysia is becoming a lot more competitive. And there's also a lot more opportunities versus before.
EduTech and AgriTech startups have been the focus for other investors as well. Maybe you can share with us the types of focus areas that you think has the high potential, particularly at a time when we're looking at post-COVID right now.
Okay, I touched on AgriTech. I think AgriTech has always historically been underfunded. And as I said earlier, I think less than 5% of funding in Southeast Asia goes within the agri and food space. And the number has shifted upwards to kind of like, I think 6-7% for the past kind of 12 to 18 months, just because there's been more appreciation of this space versus before. We've also seen kind of the first unicorn within this space. I think eFishery that came in, I think some of the local sovereigns also backed that. I think that they took about more than 10 years to grow into their valuation of, I think, $1.4 billion, right? So I think that the momentum is there from an agri and food perspective. I know you did say that there's a lot of guys targeting that space. I still feel there's not enough guys who are looking into investing in this space, just because the payoff profile actually is a bit slower than your typical commerce business. You won't kind of get like, you know, grow from 1 million to 4 million within a year. That won't happen in the early stage of agri and food startup. It'll take time to grow, right? eFishery took, I think, in total about more than a decade to grow to where it is right now. So it takes time. It means that even your typical 10-year fund may not be able to kind of digest the whole gestation period of agri and food startup, right? So I still feel there needs to be more players in the space. The more players from early stage to later stage means that there'll be a more healthy ecosystem in that space. In the education space, I think it's slightly different. It was a hot topic maybe 2 years ago. But I think if you've seen what's happening with Byju's, I think that's kind of taken kind of sort of a hit to the edutech ecosystem. At the same time, students are going back to school. So K-12 has become a very tough place to operate. I think what's key now is the guys who will do the online to offline transition very well. And I find that the online to offline transition works well from a upskilling point of view, right? So professional training, learning new courses, learning your technical courses, where there's a mix of online and offline that will optimize your output. That'll probably be the greatest kind of like investment opportunity. From a K-12 perspective, I think it's going to be difficult just because a lot of the students have gone back to school and a lot of them are still very much offline focused.
The exploration that I want to go through with you is that two sectors that I've identified, edutech and e-commerce, have taken a slump in terms of post-COVID. People used to shop a lot on e-commerce, but now they're not. EduTech, people are moving back to offline. And what you said just now was, offline to online is actually quite key as well. Are there any other sectors that you are thinking of that might not necessarily be the typical sector VC looks at? And perhaps go through with us in terms of the thinking behind looking at these non-traditional sectors for VCs to invest in.
I think, okay, it's not certainly a new area, but I think from a venture capital perspective, the semiconductor sector will be huge over the past next like 12, 24 months from a venture capital point of view, right? So historically, what we found is that a lot of these guys, you know, let's say your upstarts of the world will go straight to public markets. Why? That's because the bankers have been talking to them for the past 2-3 years. And once they reach a certain level of revenue and profitability, they can list, right? So what I find is that, hey, like us as VC guys, we've never spent time in the semiconductor space just because it's not one of the traditional VC-backed sectors, given that there's a CapEx component to it. But I think given that the strong tech angle and also the strong need for semiconductors over the whole global supply chain, and Malaysia being a key part of that, we will see a lot more opportunities in that space. And that's why we also kind of spending a lot of time to understand that space a bit better and to invest in that space, right? So I think semiconductors will be interesting, especially at a time when now the stakeholders are pushing for EVs, for local manufacturing, for bringing also foreign investors in, whether it's Infineon, whether it's Tesla, just guys who are building more capabilities locally. But I think this space has been going on for the past 30, 40 years. So it's not a new space. It's just a space where, as a VC guy point of view, it's coming to fore and it's getting a lot more interesting. So I think that's one. Number two, I think in terms of the EV ecosystem, I think that will be big. I think we are a bit lagging to our peers, whether it's, you know, Vietnam or Indonesia, who kind of attracted a lot of the EV funding, even some Singapore to a certain extent. I think slowly we'll see more guys, whether it's in Penang or here, who are building EV capabilities. I think that will be very interesting in the next 12 to 24 months.
The budget 2024 is going to be tabled just a few weeks from now. We're looking at the kind of initiatives and policies that might be looking at, particularly when it comes to interest of folks like you, VCs, and perhaps even PEs maybe. What should the government undertake to help or to actually boost Malaysian enterprises right now?
Okay, so I've always been kind of a supporter of matching funding. I think that's key. I always find that instead of, let's say, a government putting a dollar or investor putting a dollar, let's maximize it and let's say match a local dollar to a foreign dollar. I think that would be very important. So I've always pushed policymakers and stakeholders, always pushing any funding initiatives. We're cognizant that the government's not flush with money. Go for matching funding. There are sovereigns or kind of developmental agencies who would bite on that and spend time on that. I think number two, I think the recent announcement of GovTech was interesting in the sense where the government can kind of like push this all of government approach to embracing technology and procurement. I think that's a big space to play. I find that none of the startups that I speak to or know of work with government in a procurement point of view or in a meaningful way. So I think that if governments can open up even a small part of their procurement to startups and target that part of the pie, I think that'll be interesting. I've seen the Singaporeans do it. I've seen the Saudis do it. So it's not like you're reinventing the wheel. There are other countries who are also carving part of the pie out for their startup ecosystem. I still feel like, I think number three, that there needs to be a tech point person for the ecosystem and for the government, right? I think I listened to PMX talk at a Catch-Up conference like I think 3 years ago or something, and he was always talking like the one thing he'll do for tech is put like a tech czar in charge of all the agencies, right? I still feel like there needs to be one where he puts someone in charge to kind of unite all the agencies under one bucket and push the initiative moving forward. I think we are not from a lack of ideas in this country, right? I think it's a lack of execution. And if there's a tech czar who's familiar with the markets, familiar with the tech ecosystem, familiar with global fund flows and what's happening globally, to just have someone in charge and to push those initiatives, I think they'll be good because we need it, right? Like there's too many agencies, there's just too many disparate movements and a lot of guys just trying to do different things. We kind of collate all the efforts, collate the capital and kind of drive initiatives from a bottom-up perspective. I think that'll be interesting.
Maybe you can share with us in terms of the previous budget and how it aided your business.
I think the more recent announcement that PMX gave us, I think he announced R1 billion for kind of matching funding for the startups. So I think if that gets executed, that'll be great. I think historically, in previous budget, obviously Penjana Capital was launched and then the whole Penjana program, I think that was very good in terms of, I think, providing a funding. There's a lot more corporate investors in play, right? So what, lack of a better word, there's a FOMO effect. If more guys invest, more people will come to the table and more people want to play a part in this ecosystem. I think number three, I think the digitization run has been also useful for some of our startups, especially on the SaaS side, where the government kind of subsidize this part of the platform fee or software fees for these guys I think that's been useful as well in terms of just helping grow the ecosystem, right? So I think that's something that should work, but I think we still need a lot more from a moving forward perspective.
Now that the elections are over, do you feel that political risk is now mitigated? And how would outside onlookers look within Malaysia? Do you feel that they're more confident to pump in more investments into the country? And do you feel that this is a catalytic movement for us to actually grow even further now that we've achieved some sort of a stability, at least from the political risk element?
So I think we've seen over the past 6 months, like I think more investors visit Malaysia versus I think the couple of years before, whether it's COVID or not, I don't know, right? But I think post the government change in 2023, I think we've seen, I think especially your Singaporean investors or at least spending more time here to understand the market and also to understand the geopolitics and also what's happening from a moving forward perspective. The beauty of the venture ecosystem is that I think regardless of what happens from a government point of view, it'll still chug along and they'll still grow because most big businesses are dependent on private sector anyway to grow. But I think from a funding perspective, what can't be denied is a lot of the funding locally here, at least, you know, you're talking about 60-70% of it is government driven, right? So from a funding perspective, policy is important. Political stability will help just because it manages downside risk from some of these guys looking in, especially from a sovereign investor point of view, right? They don't want to be investing and then suddenly government changes and they are stuck in a rut, right? So I think that's key just because we've had quite a few government changes over the past few years. I mean, what investors logically will look at is, hey, are we going to see a period of stability in Malaysia? I think that's one. Number two is, what are the sectors we back if it's stable? So I think we've got to answer both. It's not only the political stability, but I think the sectoral point of view and what's driving the economy moving forward will be important.
Thank you very much. That was Raja Hamzah, the managing partner of RHL Ventures, joining us. Do find out what they're up to by visiting their website. Also, you can find these kind of information on astronomy.com. But for now, Raja Hamzah, thank you very much for joining us. I'm Ibrahim Sani. Catch you in the next one.